and also looking at 1 Samuel 17, 18, 19, and 20. And I put off for a few weeks some scientific discoveries, so I'm going to just take a moment to talk about a couple of them this morning before we dive into our lesson. And this one is really just days old, and I got this map up here for a reason, because a discovery was made in what are called the Altai Mountains. And there's three different Altai mountain ranges, so just not to cause any confusion, we're talking about this particular range of Altai Mountains in southern Siberia, as opposed to those that are in Mongolia and in China. And let me begin with just a couple of photos from this particular region of the Altai Mountains. This is kind of what it looks like. So it's a beautiful alpine area. Some of the peaks there are 17,000 feet high, so it's one of the higher mountain ranges in the world. And it's a place where American tourists are now starting to flood because it's got some great hiking and climbing in there as well. So, but the discovery of note is one that took place in a cave just a little bit north of the Altai Mountains. And it's at the Denisova Cave. And this is looking above the Denisova Cave. So this is kind of up in the mountains, looking down on the valley here. And the cave is about 1,000 feet below. And this particular shot is only a few feet above the cave. The cave is right underneath this particular rock here. And that's actually a research village down there, because this is a cave that's been studied literally for a couple of decades. Here's the cave itself. So it's actually quite a large cave, and it goes in quite a ways. And you can, again, can see the research. There's stairs going up here, a ladder, some stairs. And these are places that they can hang equipment. And as you can see, they've even set up a power line to support the research going on inside the cave. And there's a close-up of the cave. And actually, 3 years ago, they held an archaeology conference inside the cave. So everybody gathered around, and they were pointing out the different artifacts that existed there. Now, the reason why this cave is so famous is this is where they found a number of artifacts from early modern humans, but also from Neanderthals. They've even found some bears. And this is kind of the origin of the bear cult, because they found Neanderthal bones together with bear bones, and they presumed that the Neanderthals were worshiping the bears and some kind of a religious cult. However, now research shows that a cave of this size in such a cold climate is rare. And so everybody was using the cave for protection from the elements. Modern humans, Neanderthals, as well as bears and other creatures as well. And so the fact that we find a bunch of bones and tools, in fact, this is also the source of the claim that Neanderthals had advanced tools, because there is evidence that Neanderthals persisted up until about 30,000 years ago, and humans are already residing in this part of Siberia 40 to 45,000 years ago. So they would have overlapped. Modern humans would have used this cave, and Neanderthals, I would argue, are somewhat like the primates that we share the planet with today. They steal our stuff. And so there is evidence that Neanderthals were, quote, borrowing tools from modern humans, but we see no evidence that they were capable of using the tools as they were intended. And during the entire era of Neanderthals, before humans existed, we see no advance in their tool technology. So for a 100,000-year period, their tool technology does not advance. And the idea that it advanced when humans showed up is now presumed to be simply the fact that they were, quote, borrowing but not able to use tools from modern humans. Now, what got announced just days ago, and the paper is still not yet published in the British journal Nature, but because of the importance of the discovery, they released an online version of the paper. And this is what the paper is like right here. I got a fascinating title, The Complete Mitochondrial DNA Genome of an Unknown Hominin from Southern Siberia. Or what I saw in the popular literature, Fossil Finger Points to New Human Species. And what they found was a finger, just basically the tip of a pinky finger of some kind of hominid creature. That's all they got. And actually the finger was discovered several years ago and stashed away inside a museum and basically ignored. But you could call about a couple years ago, they discovered this Homo forensis down in Indonesia. And there was a rush of the scientific team at the Max Planck Institute. That's the institute in Germany that's famous for sequencing the genomes of ancient humans and Neanderthals. And so they rushed down to Indonesia to see if they could recover the DNA there. Because after all, dating techniques have shown that these Homo forensis creatures dated back only about 30,000 years ago. Some say as recent as 18,000 years ago. And being that recent, they said there's going to be a good chance we can recover the DNA. Well, they were disappointed. What they discovered is Indonesia, as we all know, is a warm, wet location. And warmth and moisture work to degrade DNA in a hurry. And so after a year and a half of trying to recover DNA from the Homo forensis fossil finds, and that was, you know, they thought they had a good chance because they had significant fossil remains from these Homo forensis, including the soft tissue. But they were unable to recover any DNA that wasn't completely corrupted. And now we realize you can't go to the tropics to get DNA. And so for that reason, the idea that we can get DNA from Homo sapiens idaltu, kind of a tropical version of Neanderthal, also is a hopeless case just because the climate there would not permit the DNA to remain uncorrupted. Hence the big rush to go to Siberia. Siberia, unlike the tropics, is cold and dry. And with a cave, you've got more isolation. And so now there's all this enthusiasm of going after every artifact that's been found in this cave and trying to recover the DNA. And that's basically what Pavo's team at the Max Planck Institute did. They began reading the literature and saying, let's see if we can find anything fossil remains from this cave and analyze it. So they chased down this little pinky finger and then subjected it to DNA analysis. In the back. Pardon me, what is Neanderthal? Okay. maybe I should just jump to this next slide here, okay? So we have this evolutionary... chimpanzee-like creature evolving into modern humans. And the textbooks 15 years ago were declaring that the human beings, modern humans, were directly descended from Neanderthals. This is really not how we would think a Neanderthal looks today. Now that we've got the more adequate fossil finds, we realize Neanderthals were a little shorter than we are, but heavier than we are. They had shorter legs and shorter arms, and had a huge nasal capacity. They're basically the hominid species that's got the ideal body profile for living in a very cold climate. Because it's got this barrel shape, short arms, short legs, huge nasal capacity, and that's what you need to live in a warm, in a cold place. But the reason why Neanderthal was tagged as the descendant, the ancestor of human beings, is because the brain size is comparable to our brain size. Average human brain size is about 1,600 cubic centimeters. That's also true for Neanderthals. Now, we humans have a much bigger brain-to-body mass ratio. Neanderthals were considerably heavier than we are, and so the size of the brain relative to their body is significantly smaller than it is for us human beings. But because their brain size was comparable to ours, and also, like us, they're obligatory bipedals, which means their body morphology forces them to walk on two legs. Whereas, for example, with chimpanzees, they prefer to walk on all fours, but they can walk on two legs. So they would be classified as non-obligatory in their bipedal motion. And then the creatures in between, some of them were obligatory and some were Homo erectus, and Homo neanderthalensis are obligatory. They have to walk on two legs just like we do. We don't do well trying to walk on all four fours. So But we now know that Neanderthals are not the ancestors of human beings. Number one, because of the morphology. We now know they're not anatomically identical to us. That's what I was taught when I went to school, that Neanderthals were anatomically identical to human beings. We now know that's not true by a wide margin. But what happened in 1997 is they recovered DNA from a Neanderthal specimen. And ironically, it was the Neanderthal specimen that launched Charles Darwin's Descent of Man book. The very first Neanderthal specimen discovered was in the Neander Valley in Germany, and was that very specimen from which they first recovered DNA and discovered that that DNA was markedly different from human DNA, and therefore Neanderthals could not be the ancestor of humans, and therefore they developed the story that Neanderthals and humans split off from a common ancestor a couple of million years ago. And maybe Homo erectus gave rise to both of these particular species. That was back in 1997. The textbook story now is that they have recovered DNA from 20 different specimens of Neanderthals. And as we look at those 20 specimens of mitochondrial DNA, we see that the variation within the Neanderthal species for mitochondrial DNA is quite narrow, like it is for human beings. But that the differences between the mitochondrial DNA average for Neanderthals and human beings is very different indeed. In fact, I'll show you that in a minute, just how different it is. But there's a consensus now that Neanderthals could not possibly have given rise to modern humans. So from an evolutionary perspective, they're looking for a creature much farther back to be, quote, the common ancestor of Neanderthals and human beings. The problem is, when you start going back much further, you're now looking at corrupted DNA, because these species are so far back in time that the DNA can't survive. DNA typically must be younger than 100,000 years for there to be any hope of recovering it. Now, 100,000 is what you would get if you're talking about a place that's cold and dry, like Siberia. You're talking about a place that's warm and wet. In just a few thousand years, the DNA is decayed to a point where you can't get any useful information out of it. So this kind of explains why there's this rush to go to the cold north to find these fossil fragments, because there they got the hope of recovering DNA. And what's really generating all the excitement here, maybe we've got a third species of the hominids, humans, Neanderthals, and another species from which we got DNA, and we can use this DNA to test competing creation evolution models. So that's kind of where I'm going with this. Yes?
Three things. Are they called humans? She asked me that. Are they humans, Neanderthals? Or I know they're called Homo sapien, and we're Homo sapiens sapien, but are they considered humans?
It depends who you talk to. I mean, if you talk to a human evolutionary biologist, they refer to all these creatures as human, even this character. So, but, you know, what they will see in the scientific literature is they designate present-day modern humans as Homo sapiens sapiens to distinguish from the other, quote, human-like creatures. But this is all because of the fact that in the evolutionary paradigm, they believe that all these creatures are related by natural descent. You know, trying to defend what Darwin talked about in his book, Descent of Man. That human beings are naturally descended from primate creatures, and that we share a common ancestry with the great apes, the chimpanzees and the orangutans. Yes. Okay, go ahead. That is one. Now you can bring your two other.
Since they know that they're around 18,000 years ago, man's been around 50,000. Why didn't they mention, I'm curious why the Bible never mentioned it, and did modern man mate with these guys at all or anything? I mean, did they have interaction?
Well, I'm going to get to that. Because that is one of the evolutionary suggestions that's out there, that Neanderthals and humans actually mated with one another, and that some people alive today have Neanderthal DNA. So Well, yeah, I mean, you might go to Hollywood and see a few, but or taxi drivers in New York City, but I mean, okay, no, but we'll get to why that's not a credible proposition that Neanderthals mated with them. And actually, there's been some suggestions that perhaps this new find may lead to this suggestion that there was some crossbreeding amongst these species. But yeah, as far as Homo florensis goes, there's really no talk about them being part of the human ancestry because, number one, they're very short. They call them the hobbit creatures. They're barely more than 3 feet tall, and their brain size is roughly comparable to a chimpanzee. We're talking like 400 cubic centimeters, so it's about one quarter the size of human beings. And so, you know, scientists are not seriously looking at Homo florensis as being in any way related to human beings. And as I said, they now have crossed off Neanderthal as being an ancestor of human beings. And for that matter, they've crossed off Homo erectus. Now, this diagram's a little bit distorted. Homo erectus was about 5 feet tall, so shorter, and very slim. So well adapted to the tropics, but not well adapted to cold climates. And so you can look at Homo erectus as being designed for a warm climate, Neanderthals for a cold climate, and humans able to do all. Why? Because humans could adjust their climate adaptability by wearing clothes. Of all these creatures, only humans wore clothes. Yes?
Are there any archaeological findings of human beings in the Caucasus Mountains?
Yes, in the Caucasus Mountains is another place where they're making a number of these finds. The reason for the excitement of going to the Altai Mountains is because of how cold and dry it is there. Because it's cold and dry, you've got a higher probability that DNA would be recovered. And your question about the Bible, does the Bible speak about these creatures? No, it doesn't. Just like it doesn't speak about dinosaurs. The Bible never addresses any species of life that's not common knowledge to all the people reading the Bible. So we'll talk about the lion and the bear, because everybody knows about the lion and the bear, but it is silent on the hominid species as well as dinosaurs and a number of other species. It doesn't mean, however, that there is no biblical purpose for God creating these species. As we pointed out in at least two of our books, I know it's in More Than a Theory, but I think it's also in Who is Adam, that these species, over a period of time, become progressively more capable of hunting large-bodied bird and mammal species. And humans are obviously the most capable of all. In fact, human beings are the only predator on the planet, past or present, that has had the luxury of hunting anything it wants. That was not true of Neanderthals. The Neanderthals had to content themselves with hunting the weak, the sick, the dying, and the unwary. Humans could hunt anything they wanted. But Neanderthals were by far the most capable of all the bipedal primate species previous to human beings in hunting large-bodied bird and mammal species. And so what we've written about in our books is how God created these different species in a sequence over several million years as a way to help the large-bodied bird and mammal species adapt to the coming future shock of the super predator. And evidence for that is that when human beings first invaded Australia, where bipedal primates never existed, the extinction rate when humans invaded was 86% of all large-bodied bird and mammal species within just a few hundred years were driven to complete extinction. The figure for South America was 79%, and likewise in South America we have no evidence for these bipedal primate species existing before human beings, but it's a bigger continent, so the different species would have had a greater opportunity to escape. And in North America, it was 73%, but in Africa, it was only 14%. And the figure for Asia was barely above 14%. But Asia and Africa are places that had the full complement of these bipedal primate species. So we can understand how even though the Bible is silent on this, this may be a good reason for why God created a sequence of these species over time. Yes?
Homo erectus, are they now teaching that he was the common ancestor just before a fork in the road that eventually led to humans?
Some are doing that, but some are saying that that's an absurd idea. And the reason why they're declaring it as not a rational proposition, I mean, you're right, some are suggesting, since we can now have DNA evidence proving that Neanderthals are not the ancestors of human beings, and by the way, there's DNA evidence showing that they did not interbreed, that maybe Homo erectus gave rise to both Neanderthals and human beings. The problem with that is we have fossil finds for Homo erectus that date as ancient as 1.8 million years ago and as recent as 200,000 years ago. And as we compare the most recent fossil finds to the most ancient, we can't measure a difference, which means over 1.6 million years, we see no evolution and the morphology of these creatures. And if you see no evolution and the morphology of those creatures over 1.6 million years, given how different their bone structure is from both Neanderthals and human beings, how could they ever be tagged as an evolutionary ancestor for human beings and Neanderthals? And that's actually addressed in this paper, and they're saying maybe there's something even earlier they haven't yet identified that gave rise to all of them. But the story is getting difficult to sustain because when you look at the DNA of humans over 40,000 years, we see very little difference or evolution or change in that. Likewise, with Neanderthals and the 20 specimens we have, we can't see any distinction in the DNA. So it tells us that the DNA of Neanderthals is not evolving in a measurable manner, neither as it is for human beings. So if these three creatures show no evidence of evolution within the species, how can you claim that all three of them are related through common descent? So that's kind of how the argument is going. And the reason why we're excited about this paper, Reasons to Believe, is now we've got a third species from which we've got DNA, and perhaps that can be used to put these models to a much more rigorous test than we've done already. And by the way, something else is coming down the pike, is that very shortly they'll be publishing the complete Y chromosome genome of Neanderthal. So that means we'll have nuclear DNA as well as mitochondrial DNA. And likewise, with this little finger, they're hoping to recover nuclear DNA from the finger. But the mitochondrial DNA is the easiest one to analyze because you typically have 500 sets in any particular cell. So you can use that. Whereas with the nuclear DNA, you've got two sets. So it's simply a lot easier to work with the mitochondrial DNA. But they're going after this. Well, let me take a couple more questions. I don't want to dig a little deeper into the paper. Yeah, go ahead.
If I remember correctly, going back, obviously your model has been out, recently the model's been out for a while, and the naturalist, you know, evolution one's been out. Is in the past, when we would talk about these differences, they'd always say, just give us more time to dig up more fossils, and we'll find these missing gaps and connect the dots, you know, whereas your model has always said the opposite, the more you dig, the more you're going to see there's more gaps, there's no similarity between these things. It sounds like, obviously, you know, your model is coming true, and obviously their model is failing miserably because those were always the promises. Just give us more time. You have to dig more fossils. We get more bones. We'll fill in all these dotted lines. We'll get the tree correct. And it seems the more they dig, the more their tree just sort of falls apart.
Right. And our model also predicts that we would expect there to be more of these missing links discovered in the sense that there seems to be growing evidence that with the appearance of human beings, other large body primates were driven to extinction. So it wouldn't surprise us if we actually find fossil remains for a number of large body primates that are contemporary with the first humans, because the appearance of the first humans would have been a dramatic shock to those species, and we would expect, just like Neanderthal was driven to extinction by the invasion of human beings, and probably Homo floresiensis as well, that maybe we're going to find a couple of other species. So yeah, I'm going to kind of let you know what they're thinking with this little finger. Keep in mind, all they've got is a finger. Yes.
So
God looks like he created the modern humans in order to drive everything else extinct. But what is the difference between Neanderthal and modern man in the DNA?
Okay, the difference, let me just get to that so you can actually see it. Okay. Because this is the heart of this study in this paper, is looking at the mitochondrial DNA relative to present-day humans. And so the first thing they did is they looked at 54 different human beings from all over the world, sampling all the different ethnic groups. And they also looked at a human that had been dead for 40,000 years. And what they tried to do is measure how much the mitochondrial DNA varies in the human population. So this is the average variation of human beings from the mean, which would mean, say, we're to sample everybody in this room, because quite a few of us are from different ethnic groups, so we should get a good sampling here, even in this room. That's the advantage of teaching a class in Los Angeles. You get good ethnic diversity. So if we were to sample the mitochondrial DNA of everybody in this room, we would differ approximately by 30 nucleotide sites in our mitochondrial DNA from the average in this class. So this would be the dispersion that you would see in the human population. Now, what about Neanderthals? They differ relative to the average of human beings by 202 sites. So you can see that they're markedly different from humans, and because of that marked differentiation, there's now a consensus in the scientific community that Neanderthals could not possibly have played a role in the natural descent of humanity. They're just too different from us. Now, in terms of this individual they found in this cave in Denisova, this is the differences, 385, which led the people who wrote the paper to conclude that this individual cannot be related to Neanderthals nor to human beings. It's just too big of a difference. But the difference with respect to humans is much greater than it is to Neanderthals. And so what they were concluding in the paper is that this particular individual either is a Homo erectus or Homo florensis, the one they found in Indonesia, or it's a completely different species altogether. And they're kind of hoping it's a completely different species, because that would really make their paper quite a breakthrough thing. And just for completeness, they also compared it with chimpanzees. So you can see how far apart chimpanzees are from humans. But this is so far away from Neanderthals and humans, they said, it can't be either one. It's got to be a species distinct from Neanderthals and humans. And kind of what was exciting about this paper, typically when they announce a discovery of a new species, it's based on extensive bone evidence. In this case, all they got is the tip of a pinky finger, but what they're now saying is, we don't need the bones, all we need is the DNA. We got the DNA, we can actually identify this as a distinct species. So it's the first time in the literature where DNA by itself actually identified a distinct species. But because we don't have DNA from Homo erectus or DNA from Homo forensis, we can't demonstrate that it is a species distinct from either one. Although in the paper they point out, undoubtedly, it can't be Homo forensis, because there's no way Homo forensis would be able to survive successfully in this particular environment. But maybe Homo erectus, that's still a candidate. Yes?
I thought Homo erectus went down now to 100,000 years ago, maybe even less than that.
Well, there's some speculation. In other words, the fact that we've got bones that date as recently as 200,000 years ago has led to some speculation that maybe Homo erectus survived into, say, 100,000 years ago. So, but what we do see with Homo erectus is that the fossil evidence declines rapidly with time. So most of that evidence for Homo erectus is between 1 and 1.8 million years ago. Once you get more recent than 1 million years ago, the evidence declines sharply, which tells us that the population of Homo erectus must be suffering a severe decline once you get more recent than a million years, and therefore there's quite a bit of doubt expressed in the scientific community that they could have overlapped Neanderthals or humans. But now that they found this little pinky finger, they're saying maybe this is it. Maybe Homo erectus really did survive that recently. But The paper is reasonably quite skeptical if that's the case. In fact, they're saying maybe we got a brand new species, but their whole point is all we got's a pinky finger. We're not going to put our name on the claim of a new species until we got more evidence. And what they're doing right now is analyzing that pinky finger to see if they can recover nuclear DNA. Because they said if we get nuclear DNA to complement the mitochondrial DNA, then we can make a more definitive conclusion on what we've discovered here.
Is that what they found? That's not just a pinky?
Just a pinky finger. And so...
It's a big cave. They didn't find the remains right there?
Nope. So,
I better go and help them.
Well... What this paper has done, I mean, already the leader of this team, Faba, has been organizing his Max Planck Institute on anthropology to try to analyze every museum piece they can find that's from a cold climate. That effort's not going to be stepped up. They're going to be scouring the museums of the world to try to pick up anything, any fossil remain, and it probably won't be limited to just the hominid line. They're going to go after everything that comes from a cold, dry climate that is relatively recent. Now, there's also a lot of debate on the date for this creature. What they discovered is it fell between two strata within the cave, one that dates 30,000 years ago and one that dates 48,000 years ago. So the presumption is its date lies between 30 and 48,000 years ago. But all they got is a stratigraphic date. And so there's always the possibility that that little pinky finger somehow got moved around inside that, so it's not considered to be a reliable date. And some have suggested, well, maybe it really is Homo erectus, and maybe it is several hundred thousand years old. Well, that's doubtful, because if it was, say, 200,000 years old or 300,000 years old, even with that cold, dry climate, you wouldn't get uncorrupted DNA. And they did get a fairly decent DNA from this sample. So that would argue that the date of 30 to 48,000 years ago is probably reasonable. Because if it was older than that, then the DNA would be too corrupted for them to be able to get any kind of analysis from it. And they were quite successful. Therefore, it must be relatively young. But that's the best we got for a date. We got nothing like the dates we have for the Neanderthal specimens in the back. Yeah, well, I mean, all they looked at was the, I mean, all they had literally was the tip of the pinky finger. But if you look at your own hand, you'll know that the bone structure of the pinky is a little bit different than it is for the other digits. So that's how they concluded it was a pinky finger. However, there's debate expressed in the paper. Is this the pinky finger of an adult? Is it the pinky finger of a juvenile? They don't have enough of the bone to really determine at what point in the developmental process do we have this pinky. And see, that causes some confusion, because if it's an adult, maybe it could belong to a small bipedal primate species. And that actually fueled the speculation that maybe this really is Homo forensis. Because if it's from an adult and it's that tiny, then the creature can't be very big. But if it's a juvenile, then it really could be, say, a Homo erectus. But it's that kind of speculation that caused the authors of this paper to say, we're not going to speculate. We're going to wait before we claim that we have found a new species, or before we claim it's Homo erectus. But they were quite dismissive of the idea that it's Homo forensis, because they said, how would Homo forensis be able to get to this place and be able to survive in that kind of a climate range? So... but it's also challenging to figure out how Homo erectus will survive there, given how cold it is. So, you know, Siberia isn't that pleasant of a place, especially up at that high of an altitude. Yeah, go ahead.
Even before we got all the DNA evidence, recover all the DNA from the Neanderthals, it was pretty much concluded that Neanderthals couldn't be related to human, because obviously we talked about the huge nasal capacity. I think it's like, what, 6, 7, 8 times the size of ours?
Yes.
Capacity. The other one that you didn't mention, obviously, is no tear ducts in the Neanderthals, the bone structure. So, wasn't it pretty much true that before we recovered the DNA, it was already coming to that conclusion that people realized that the animal? So the question, obviously, is did the DNA evidence there wind up matching the anatomical differences that we had already seen in Neanderthals? Did the DNA come where we anticipated? Somebody had to anticipate what the DNA would be based on that the Neanderthal was just so different than us.
We're not there yet, Dave. Okay, I mean, we don't have a sufficiently... I mean, that's one of the reasons they're going after the Y chromosome genome, as that may enable them to actually correspond some of the genes they see there with physical features. But with the mitochondrial DNA, that's not possible. So we don't know yet. But you are right. I mean, those of you who have been reading the magazines put out from Facts for Faith will remember we published quite a few articles on Neanderthals before the DNA was discovered. And even back in the late 1980s and early 1990s, there was accumulating evidence that they had significant morphological differences. So in the 1980s and 1990s is when the textbook statement that Neanderthals were anatomically identical to humans was challenged. The bone that permits the spinal cord to go up into the brain has a different shape for Neanderthals than it does humans. One's circular, one's elliptical. As you mentioned, the nasal capacity is huge. In fact, this is what's stunning about Neanderthals. Its nasal capacity is so enormous that they can't relate Neanderthals to any mammal species, period. Neanderthals have a nasal capacity out of proportion to its body size that's just an order of magnitude greater than we see in any other mammal species. But it's exactly what you would need for a large-bodied creature that's going to be hunting, living in a cold climate. You know how we humans deal with it? We deal with it by wearing the appropriate clothing that gives us an artificial nasal capacity. So, for example, when I was doing radio astronomy in Canada, the best observing was when the temperature was 50, 55 below zero. But when it's that cold, you can't go outside unprotected. What will happen is if you go outside unprotected, as you take a breath into your mouth and into your lungs, it will actually burn the trachea of your lungs. And so in order to prevent lung damage, you have to wear a special parka that basically has this tube that goes out like this. It's hard to see out of the parka, but what it does is allows the air to warm up before it hits your nose, then warm up a little bit more before it goes into your lungs. Now, Neanderthal had the anatomy to deal with that without a parka. It had this huge nasal capacity, which meant it could breathe in cold air without the lung tissue being damaged by that cold air. But we don't see that in any other species, that kind of a huge nasal capacity. And so, really, in terms of trying to identify an ancestor of Neanderthal, you can't pick one. All the mammals are distinct from the Neanderthals. But now we know, of course, that the Neanderthals had a much bigger barrel-shaped body structure, short limbs, short legs. All of that's important if you want to live in a cold place. The longer your limbs, the more you're going to be exposed to the elements and the more quickly you're going to suffer death by freezing. But Neanderthals could contain their body heat. Yes?
Yeah, I was I visited the Neanderthal Valley in Germany where they first found the and they had a museum there, a great museum, and they had models of Neanderthals camping by the river. They look just like us. Now, another thing, which is probably more interesting, more important, is that you go from, can you put the other slide back with showing the chimps and everything? All these animals have more or less the same organs that we have. So if we're intelligently designed, somebody used the same hearts. I mean, they got livers, they got hearts, they got nasals, they got whatever sexual equipment, whatever you. It's all, you know. See what I mean? Somebody intelligently designed this. Use the same parts for, including the guy in the back.
Well, that's the argument for intelligent design. You repeat the optimal designs.
So he was using those same parts over.
Of course.
Yeah. Use them in a pig too. Pigs are almost anatomically the same as us, also bipedal primates.
So these guys in the back there also were holy people.
Well, you know, all these individuals, you're right, have nearly identical internal organs, the liver, the lungs, the heart, very close, so close that you can actually take a heart out of a baboon and put it in a human being, and it will work. And some have pointed out that God did that on purpose, so to help our medical industry. And if you look at the lung, there's been a lot of study done on the lung about, you know, can we actually make a better lung than we see in the human body? And the answer is no. It's at the very optimal limit. You cannot process oxygen from the environment any more efficiently than we see in the lung. Well, given it's the most efficient design possible, it would make sense that the Creator would repeat that in all the creatures that need to be able to live at a high activity level. And see, all these creatures, they're large body, they're living at a high activity level. It would make sense that they would have nearly identical internal organs. But if you look at the brains, that's where you really see the big differences. Neanderthal had a brain about the same size as ours. It had this huge nasal capacity, and one of the reasons for that nasal capacity was so that he could smell, because that's how he would go about hunting. Notice that we don't use our noses to hunt creatures. We have a terrible sense of smell. And that's because what the Creator did is he took all that brain matter that Neanderthals used to be able to smell out their prey and transferred that to the part of our brain that's able to do higher level mathematics. Neanderthals weren't very good at math. Humans are very good at math. We're terrible at smelling, but they're very good at being able to smell things. Probably a better eyesight, better hearing than we did. They were definitely stronger than us.
They were built,
But consider how much of your brain you need just to support your muscles. And so one of the reasons why the human species is so much weaker than these creatures that preceded us. I mean, for example, if you try to fight a 100-pound chimpanzee, you will lose. The chimpanzee is much stronger than a 200-pound man. And that's because more of its brain is devoted to supporting its muscles. And you say, why not for human beings? Because the human brain already is at the maximum size. You cannot make the human brain any bigger. If you try, it will cook itself to death. And so it's important that the human brain not be any bigger than what it is. In fact, if your child has a fever, you quickly try to bring the fever down, because that fever is in danger of killing brain cells. And so with the human brain being at the maximum size, and with God wanting that human brain to be able to support worship, meditation, philosophy, mathematics, playing a Liszt piano concerto, all that requires sacrificing brain matter that normally would go to making a bigger, stronger, faster creature and to making one that's capable of intellectual activity. So, you know, in evidence for that, Neanderthal couldn't advance his technology. His technology remained the same, was primitive, and never wore clothes, and we see no evidence that he was engaging in philosophy or religious experiences. Yes?
Is there any speculation of why the Neanderthal was designed without the tear ducts?
I don't know why the Neanderthal was designed without the tear ducts. I do know, having lived in a cold place of Canada, that the tear ducts can be a real problem in a cold climate.
Icing over your eyes.
Well, no, what happens is you're in this warm building and you put on all these parka-type clothing and gloves and so forth. Then you go outside, and as soon as you hit that cold, your eyes tear, and then the tears freeze, and it's very painful. And one of the reasons why you kind of wear this special parka is to do what you can to prevent your tears from freezing. And you got into the habit of always trying to make sure that everything was dry. And what you really want to do, in fact, you see this in Canada, they got what they call a cold room, where you go from the warm house, and they have a little room which is between the house and the front door. And it's kept at an intermediate temperature. That's to allow your body to adapt to going outside. You don't want to go from, say, 70 degrees to 50 below. The body doesn't do well adapting to a 120-degree change. And so you want to kind of... So what we would do is we would go into the cold room where it would be roughly freezing, you know, about 32 degrees, and there we would put on all our warm clothes. You don't want to put on your warm clothes in the house, because then you'll start sweating immediately. And you don't want to sweat, because that's going to freeze, and that's not a good thing either. So,
what about the Eskimos? Do they have tear ducts?
Yes, they have tear ducts. But again, they use the same technique. They go from a warm place to a colder place, then they go outside. So,
and we always
wear
the parka.
Yeah.
Big seal fur around it.
Oh, even the igloos, you know, they're not that warm inside the igloo. So, yes.
Well, Al said our modern brain allows skepticism, but and there may be a spiritual base to that, but also skepticism is part of our logical structure, our logic structure, and logic structure is a very powerful and valid set of processes for science and for theology. In my study of apologetics, it's huge in its valid application for apologetics.
Right. Yeah, in fact, I would argue that the Bible exhorts us to be skeptical, but not to be cynical. There's a difference between cynicism and skepticism. But as we all know, you've got 1 Thessalonians 5:21. Test everything, hold fast to that which is good. But you can't do that unless you've got a brain that's structured a certain way. We have that. These other creatures did not. So, in the back. No. The reason why you see in some scientific papers a speculation that Neanderthals were holding religious services is because they found the remains of Neanderthal bones within 30 feet of pollen grains. And so the assumption was that they were using flowers as part of a religious service. But, I mean, there could be other reasons to explain why you got pollen grains showing up 30 feet away from Neanderthal bones. It doesn't necessarily mean there's a religious service. Likewise, there are people who speculated that you see charcoal remains next to Neanderthal bones, and maybe they were using fire as part of a religious service. But again, that's quite a leap. In fact, evidence now demonstrates that Neanderthals did not control fire, but there were times when they exploited fire. So in other words, if there was a grass fire going on, they may be able to use that natural grass fire as a way to cook their meat, maybe not, maybe burn something, we don't know. All we got is charcoal remains within the same vicinity of Neanderthal bones, and how those charcoal remains are related to Neanderthals is pure speculation. We don't know. But we do know with humans and their archaeological remains, you actually see hearths. So clearly they were controlling the fire, but you don't see that with Neanderthals. But it's possible Neanderthals exploited fire, either started by human beings or by lightning strikes. Okay. Pardon me? It's possible humans were eating Neanderthals. Something drove them to rapid extinction, because as soon as humans show up on the scene, we see a rapid disappearance of the Neanderthals. So that's certainly a possibility. Yes?
Is there any human art that's old enough to potentially show any of these creatures, or it's all too new?
None of the ancient human art shows Neanderthal-like specimens.
But is it even old enough to have potentially shown them and they chose not to show
them? Well, the oldest cave art that we see is 33,000 years old. And the most ancient Neanderthal is 30,000 years. So there's a slight overlap. But by the time you get down to, say, 35,000 years ago, the population of Neanderthals must have been extremely low. So they were already on the way out at that time. Possible. But we don't see anything in the most ancient art depicting some barrel-shaped creature with short legs, no.
And we don't even have much art from back then anyway.
We have quite a bit. I mean, but almost all of it's in Spain and France. And it dates between 17,000 years ago and 33,000 years ago. And, you know, that's another argument against the evolutionary paradigm, is that we don't see any evolution in the quality of the art. The most ancient art is worthy of being displayed in art museums today. So, you know, we humans today are really no better in our artistic expression than artists were 33,000 years ago. Yes. Yeah, most of it's depicting animals.
Animals.
Right. But some of the depictions are amazingly...
They have some hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that particular cave dates at 17,000 years.
Oh.
Right. And by the way, the museums that show all these Neanderthals, just like in Germany, and if you go to Washington, you'll see a museum with Neanderthals in it. The curators there will admit that the Neanderthals on display need to be corrected. They need to be corrected. They no longer represent what Neanderthals look like. So yeah, when you visit those museums, you say, gee, that just looks like Uncle Joe. Keep in mind that all that needs to be radically corrected based on new discoveries that they're not anatomical.
Right where they found them. You know, they
right.
found them by a river, and they found them. So they look so much like us. They're, you know, they're engaged in all these activities. They're having babies and, you know, taking care of them. And
well,
fire.
Al, when I was educated in the 1960s, what our textbooks taught was that Neanderthals cannot be distinguished from humans in their morphological structure. Their skeletons are identical to ours, and the thought was that Neanderthals were part of the human lineage. In fact, the textbook model was that Europeans were Neanderthals and that Asians were part of Homo erectus. Well, those textbooks are wrong based on what we discovered. We now know all that needs to be corrected. And so when you meet someone of European descent, they're not Neanderthals. So likewise, Asians are not Homo erectus. We are distinct from both. But yeah, we need to change those museum models because they're definitely wrong.
But so 17,000 years ago in this cave, so that was right at the, the Neanderthals had been extinct by then, right? When they found the.
But some of the caves, the ark is as ancient as 33,000 years. So at that time, there would have been a possibility, but only a possibility, that the humans may have been aware of the Neanderthals. You know, as my colleague Fuzz Rana points out, when you get to 30 to 50,000 years ago, the population of Neanderthals is very tiny. And it's quite possible that humans had no contact with Neanderthals at all, just because of how tiny the population of the Neanderthals were. Yes?
Then where do the rumors or hearsay come from that I've heard from several different people that say that Neanderthals did art and buried their dead and controlled fire and used tools and conducted religious ceremonies that where they were actually buried with the tools that they used, and is this completely fabricated?
No, it's not completely fabricated. In fact, that was the textbook model back in the 1960s, and it was all based on the fact that they found pollen grains in the same vicinity as Neanderthal bones, and they found charcoal in the same vicinity as Neanderthal bones, and therefore art, no. But they did find, what was famous for about a 25-year period was the claim that they had found a Neanderthal flute. And what it was the bone of a leg bone of a creature with two holes in it. And so the presumption was that those holes were drilled by Neanderthals and that they were playing music. That has now been withdrawn. Because evidence now shows that the holes were drilled by the fangs of a saber-toothed tiger. And all they had were the two holes anyway. So it's no longer considered to be evidence of a flute. So we only have evidence for music coming from human beings. And the thing about human beings, as soon as humans show up, immediately you've got musical instruments. And they're carved from ivory, very exquisite carving. Really complex of musical instruments, they show up right away. The art shows up in advanced form right away. Now, as far as the tool argument goes, we do see tools associated with Neanderthals that take a step function upwards as soon as humans appear. But now anthropologists believe that it's simply Neanderthals borrowing those tools from human beings rather than using them. Yeah, we actually see primates doing that today.
Did they bury their dead, though, purposefully with tools?
Well, you do find tools there, and they may have been human tools that they weren't using. Because, like with this cave, that cave was occupied by both humans and Neanderthals, and they overlapped. I mean, a cave like that is a rare find, and then when the weather's cold, where are you going to go to get to try to stay warm?
The question is, what did they use? So the question is, were they purposefully buried? Was there forethought and burial rituals?
That's the presumption. The presumption is because we find them within 30 feet of the same location, that maybe that portrays that they're actually engaged in worship. But it's very different than what you've got with modern humans. With modern humans, you actually see a sacrificial hearth. You see idols that have been carved out of ivory. We get nothing like that for the Neanderthals. So it's simply evolutionists, driven by their paradigm, looking at the scantest piece of evidence and then drawing conclusions that now the scientific literature indicates is simply not warranted. So most anthropologists have backed away from those kinds of claims. Just because, you know, just because it's 30 feet away doesn't mean it's being used for that purpose. So, John. Yeah, what they were using the pollen grains for, we really don't know. We don't even know they were using the pollen grains. I mean, pollen shows up everywhere. So all they know is that the pollen grains that have been found in the vicinity of the Neanderthal bones are the pollen grains of flowers. They've not identified the species. They just think it's some kind of flowering plant. So,
and stone altars too. That's what.
Well, the stone altar claim is something that's been disputed because you only see that when the Neanderthals are overlapping human beings. And so they may have been simply exploiting a hearth that a human being had used. So we have no evidence that they were actually controlling fire. That, again, was in the textbooks. I remember reading that back in the 60s, that Neanderthals had control over fire and were very inventive people. Those claims have been completely withdrawn. In fact, we're not even sure if Neanderthal accidentally exploited fire.
That puts them back with the apes. I mean,
yeah, exactly. I mean, that really is what we're saying, is that these creatures are much more akin to this creature than they are to that creature or this creature. They're apes. They're not human. We shouldn't be calling them hominids. But that's what you see in the scientific literature, is that they often refer to all of these creatures as being humans, when in fact the evidence is telling us they're apes, they're not humans. So, okay, I was going to get to another discovery, but I'm running out of time. I've only got 5 minutes. But I will give you at least an introduction, and maybe we can get to it next time. So that's the situation there. But what I also want to talk to you about is at the other end of the scale. By the way, if you want to get in more into this, we at Reasons to Believe did 4 Science News Flash podcasts. They're available on our website. They're also available on iTunes. And if you want to get these as a subscription, all you got to do is sign up. And you can get them sent to your computer for free every time talk about one of these discoveries. And the fun thing is, we talked about this discovery literally hours after the discovery was announced. So you get it right away, and your computer will get a little signal that says Science News Flash for Reasons to Believe available. And you can listen to it as you drive home from work or during your lunch break at the office or whatever. But literally, we did 4 of these in the past week. Yes? Yes? Can you see the comparisons?
Is it up for that?
No, but I've got them on my computer. It would take me a little bit of time to dig them out, but I could actually show you what a Neanderthal skull looks like and a human skull looks like. They're roughly the same size, although the Neanderthal skull's on a much bigger body than ours. And if you actually dig into the interior of the skull, what you discover is that the human had a parietal lobe, a really large parietal lobe, and we don't see the bone structure supporting that in the Neanderthal. So it appears that humans alone have a large parietal lobe, and that's the part of our brain that we use for worship, meditation, philosophy, mathematics, invention, and science. So it explains why the human species alone was capable of advancing technology. These other creatures aren't. Some of these creatures use tools, but in every case, we see that they were not capable of advancing their technology. And by the way, when we talk about tools, up until the appearance of human beings, the most advanced tools you see is where, say, a Neanderthal will take a boulder and smash it against another boulder with its great strength, splinter it into pieces, kind of rummage through the pieces, and find a nice sharp shard that it uses for scraping meat off a bone. That's the most advanced you'll see. There are no axes, there are no needles, there are no hammers, there's no saws. The best is simply fragments of rocks that are used for different purposes. And you don't see Neanderthals advancing their technology again until humans come along, and there is some evidence that they stole our stuff in the same manner that monkeys and chimpanzees will steal our stuff. In fact, the amazing thing about the primates we share the planet with is they're almost compulsive thieves. If any of you have ever had a pet monkey, you'll know that it will steal almost anything. Won't use it, but it will steal it. And so there's now the recognition that's probably the case with Neanderthals and some of these other species.
Didn't they have they had to have consciousness with all that that big brain? Didn't they have consciousness like we have?
Apparently not. It's the parietal lobe that really motivates you to ask questions. Why am I here? I mean, I've got a really smart cat, but that cat never asks that kind of question. Never worries about why he's here on the earth. All he's worried about is where his food dish is and things like that.
That's a huge brain, you know. Why waste it like that? I mean,
well, it wasn't wasted, Al. That huge brain was used to support those powerful muscles. After all, it's bipedal. That takes quite a bit of brain to support that, the internal organs, and the sense of smell, the eyes. See, with a human, we sacrificed all that so that we could actually ask philosophical questions. It takes a fair amount of your brain capacity just to engage in things like philosophy and mathematics and being able to play a piano and type on a computer. You put a chimpanzee by a computer, he can't type as fast as we can. And if he does type fast, gibberish comes out. So, but I mean, if you actually look at these creatures, they cannot type fast.
Yeah, well, I'm just going by the brain side. That's a huge brain like ours. And use it to beat one rock on another.
That was also used for smell. We discussed that already.
Right.
A large part of the brain was also...
Well, consider this. Look how big the brain of a dog is. 40% of its brain supports its nose. Okay, in our case, it's less than 0.4% that supports our nose. So we have a horrible sense of smell, but I'm glad we got a horrible sense of smell because it enables us to read the Bible, read the Astrophysical Journal, and talk about things like we talk about in this class. You know, we had a bunch of Neanderthals here. They wouldn't be able to understand a thing that we're doing. They wouldn't have the brain to be able to support all that. So, let's close. All right. Father in heaven, thank you for the day and age in which we live. And Father, we thank you for the discovery, this new DNA specimen, and how the possibility exists that we'll find more DNA, not only of that particular specimen, but other specimens. And we'll wind up with a database kind of like we have with the Neanderthals, where we have over a dozen such creatures. And we can use this to rigorously put to the test competing models of creation evolution, even within the church. And Father, I do pray that this DNA evidence would challenge people within the church to reconsider their theistic evolutionary paradigm, their young earth creationist paradigm, the framework hypothesis paradigm. Lord, really, make us people that put everything to the test and hold to that which is good. And may that cause us to worship you with a greater sense of confidence than we've been able to do before. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.
You have to change that slide, the one with the
football player on it?
Yeah, but the fact that one's black. There is a great traditional racial stereotype that blacks are equivalent or below monkeys. So you've got the...